you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Professor Graham McQueen back on the show. Graham is a retired member of the Religious Studies Department at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. He received his doctorate in Buddhist Studies from Harvard University in 1989. Graham helped found the McMaster Center for Peace Studies, which he directed from 1989 to 1996. He is now the co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. Is that still current?
The journal is still current, but I'm no longer the co-editor.
Okay. So you're the former. Okay, so that's okay.
Yeah.
You're also the author of the 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy. I think that was the book we talked about last year in our previous interview, and I urge everyone to go out and buy that book. It's a very, well, it's a refresher on that whole case, and of course it examined the strange links between the anthrax attacks and the 9/11 attacks, because people forget that originally those attacks were indeed linked by the mainstream media, then just forgotten. Yet those links still exist, which help, reveal the falsity of the official narrative of the 9/11 attacks. So I urge everyone to go out and get that book. It's an excellent book. You recently penned an article. I read it on Center for Global Research's website. 9/11, the Pentagon's B movie. So let's talk about this piece. What motivated you to write this piece, and what is this piece about?
Yes, well, thank you. There's kind of a long history to it, so let me give you the shortish version of this. The fact that the 9/11 attacks looked like something out of a movie was obvious to many people right away, and I was one of them. So, for example, my university, McMaster University in Canada, put on, or I should say a bunch of us put on at the university, a teach-in a few days after 9/11, very, very shortly after the events. And it was well attended. A lot of students were there. A lot of people were upset. A lot of people were concerned. And so a few of us gave brief talks, and then we broke off into little groups to discuss and came back with some recommendations and all that thing. And during my talk, one of the things I noted was how much the events looked like a B movie. And I didn't have, I suppose you'd say, the confidence at that point to say, and they were a B movie. I didn't actually question, in other words, the official story that was being pushed at that time. I assumed that probably it was more or less true that some Islamic terrorists did this. And in that case, presumably these terrorists had been watching some Hollywood movies, because this really was right out of the movies. And it was scarcely believable. And that's what I said in the teach-in. I said that people could accurately hit these buildings, and that the buildings, these enormous tall buildings, would then collapse, permanently changing the skyline of New York City. And that as a result of this, various wars would be triggered, because, of course, I was teaching peace and war at that time, and I knew perfectly well that wars were going to be triggered by these events. So I was raising questions about it, but I myself fell into this kind of slumber, as most academics did, and almost all of them really, thinking, oh, well, I guess the official story must be more or less true, even though we haven't been shown any decent evidence, but everyone seems to think so, so we'll go along with it. Of course, I'm embarrassed by that now. And it took me some years to really say, you know what, this is so important. I'm out here trying to prevent all these wars, invasion of Afghanistan, invasion of Iraq, the destruction of one country after another. Maybe I really should have a look at that event. And so I started looking at it. I mean, I'd looked at it a little bit over the years, but not in a critical way till 2005. And I was really struck by how quickly I was able to see through the official story. And of course, at that point, you begin to really wonder, okay, so this is a filmic event. That is, it looks like a movie. It's obviously designed to terrify people, to create a sense of awe, a sense of, the kind of conditions where civil society will give their power to the national security institutions and say, here, please take our civil rights and just protect us because we're scared. And yeah, you can go on the rampage internationally, you can invade countries illegally because we're scared and because somebody has attacked us. So it's clear that somebody had created a great dramatic event in order to provoke those responses in people. And let me say right away, when I call it a dramatic event or a movie or fiction, I don't mean that people didn't die. Of course they did. This was an event of horrifying violence. It was an act of mass murder. This is clear. But it was more than that. It was clearly a psychological operation. And by the way, psychological warfare and terrorism are very closely connected. Most terrorism is a psychological operation. Most psychological operations are terrorism. So that's one set of things that was happening in my mind. I was coming more and more to the realization that somebody had scripted this thing and that it wasn't Islamic terrorists that had scripted it. The other thing that was happening was that starting in late 2005, early 2006, I began studying the oral histories of the Fire Department of New York. This is 10 to 12,000 pages of firsthand material by people from that department who were actually on the scene at 9/11. And of course, as we know, well over 300 members of the FDNY perished on that day. But this is the oral histories. These are interviews with roughly 500 survivors from the fire department. And one of the things, there were a lot of things that struck me. I mean, the main thing that I wrote about at that time in 2006, it was that I published an article on 118 witnesses, I guess it was called, talking about all the firefighters who witnessed explosions in the building right before they collapsed. But along with that, I also ran into all these accounts of how they felt like they were in a movie. And I didn't know what to do with that. Were they just, was that just a way of saying, well, you know, this was such extreme violence and such an unusual event that I had a sense of unreality about me? Because people do get that sometimes in events of that sort. But the more I looked at it, the more I thought, no, it's much more specific than a sense of unreality. I mean, if all they felt was a sense of unreality, they could have said that. And in fact, quite a few of them do. But what I was talking about here was much more specific stuff, like saying I felt like I was on the set at Universal Studios, or someone saying, you know, I've been a firefighter in disasters and high-rise fires and everything for over 2 decades in New York City, but I've never seen anything that even began to resemble this. I could not believe what was happening. It looked like a movie, and a movie, a movie, a movie. These references went on and on, and after I'd collected about, I think, 28 of these references, I thought, you know, I've got to do something with this, but I didn't know what to do with it. So it kind of sat there as one among several things that I had collected, kind of strange anomaly. And then finally, recently, I was thinking I wanted to write an article for the 16th anniversary of the events. And I, you know, brainstormed about various things I could write about. And I thought, why not look into this issue of people thinking this seemed like a movie? And so that's what I wrote about, and that's what the article is, The Pentagon's B-Movie. Some people who've actually worked in television and film have told me I shouldn't have used the term B-Movie. I should have called it something like Blockbuster.
Yeah.
Because it was very expensive and very, in some ways, sophisticated. Whereas B-movies are usually cheapies and, you know, they're crummy and the special effects are very poor and so on. But whether we call it a B-movie or a blockbuster, it doesn't really matter. The question is, there's something about it that is uncomfortably like a film. And when we begin to investigate this, the event begins to unfold. We begin to be able to make sense of certain things. Not only do the real perpetrators become clear to us, but also I began to realize that it helps us understand why things were designed the way they were, these building so-called collapses, for example, and also why people have been convinced of this and have been so moved by this over the years, despite the fact that it's been shown again and again to have been a false narrative. So we can get into those things if you like, but I began to find all those things started to come together for me.
Yes, you mentioned in the article early on how elements of the movie, what we witnessed, or you know, most of us witnessed it through the medium of television, which again raises all sorts of doubts about about reality. That's more the case than more people are willing to entertain, really. But the idea that, you know, what we're witnessing, it violates the laws of physics, yet we accept it because it's on the screen. You have a couple of quotes from, I thought it was very helpful, from movie directors. One, Lawrence Wright, who was a screenwriter for The Siege, and his quote is, "It was about an hour after the first Trade Center came down that I began to make the connection with the movie, the haunting feeling at the beginning, this looks like a movie. And then I thought, it looks like my movie." Then you have Stephen D'Souza, who wrote the screenwriter for Die Hard and Die Hard 2. Of course, Die Hard 1, I think, involves a big explosion on a high rise, and I think Die Hard 3, which maybe he didn't write about, involves false flag terror or terrorist attacks carried out throughout New York City to facilitate a huge heist, which some people see as one of the deeper dimensions of the 9/11 event, a big heist. But his quote is, "Well, it did look like a movie. It looked like a movie poster. It looked like the one." One of my movie posters.
Yeah.
So that's very telling, or at least suggestive.
Yes. Well, sorry, this was one of the starting points for the article. I thought this would be a good way to start off by noting that Hollywood scriptwriters had looked at the events of 9/11 as they unfolded and said, holy cow, yeah, this sure does look like a movie. And then we go on from there.
Mm-hmm. And you say, you know, you build the case, or you have some bullet points that 9/11 attacks were filmic, like a film, in at least the following ways. Given the complex and coordinated nature of these attacks, they had been scripted and given a timeline in advance. Given the need to make decisions as the attacks progressed, for example, when the aircraft went off course or was delayed, it is clear that there was a director. Given the overall vision, the need for funds, resources, and international coordination over a period of years, it's obvious that there had been a producer. Given the numerous roles played in this event, for example, by the hijackers, in quotes, quotation marks, there were undoubtedly actors. And that, you can read a lot into that, but I know what you're saying is that this wasn't an attack carried out by an autonomous, an autonomous terrorist cell functioning out of Al-Qaeda. The important aspect of terrorism is, I think historically, at least what history demonstrates, is that terrorism, for the most part, has always been state-directed or controlled.
Yes, states have, from the outset, been heavily involved in terrorism. Now, there is non-state terrorism, mm-hmm. but its importance these days is greatly exaggerated. The non-state terrorist doesn't have the kind of resources that state terrorism has. And 9/11 is a good example of this. The kinds of funds that the 9/11 Commission report thinks were adequate to pull this off are absurd. They're just nowhere near what you would need to plan and pull off an operation like this. And I say that as somebody who occasionally was managing fairly big projects when I was still in the university. And, there's no way you could pull something like this off without many, many millions of dollars over a long period of time. And states have access to that, not just the funds, of course, but also the equipment.
And also, to the extent that they did expose, for example, the payment from the Pakistani ISI to the alleged hijackers, the 9/11 Commission said that was of no significance, this money trail.
That's right. They estimate very low amounts of money, and then they express no interest in going after it. At the very least, it's a completely insincere investigation, and of course, it may be worse than that.
And of course, we're to believe this whole attack was carried out by, I guess, a few of these perpetrators going into a local hardware store getting some box cutters and.
Right.
That was pretty much it, I guess, because they were able to successfully commandeer four aircraft with box cutters.
That's right. And they were said to have threatened to blow the place up and to have said they had bombs on them, but no indication, the FBI says, that they actually did have bombs or that any bombs went off in the Trade Center, which isn't one of the many anomalies if you look at this, because of course the FBI quite rapidly came up with its own code name for what happened on 9/11, and the code name is Pent Bomb, which stands for the Pentagon Twin Towers bombing. And it seems as if somebody in the FBI at some stage thought there was a bombing, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, on the day of 9/11 itself, we had journalists reporting that, one of the FBI's theories at the moment is that bombs were set off. And then, of course, as the official story is pushed down everyone's throat, which it is quite rapidly, suddenly there's no bombing. No bombing at the Pentagon, no bombing at the Twin Towers. Terrorists didn't have real bombs. Nobody had bombs. How do we know this? Good question. National Institute of Standards and Technology admits it didn't bother looking in the dust for evidence of explosives. And that's something the FBI should have done right away. But as far as I know, there's no report that they did. So it's, you have these anomalies, this sense right from the way that something is dramatically wrong here.
Of course, in the case of the Twin Towers, they offer an implausible explanation. And with the World Trade Center 7, they offer no explanation. They say the official report is no explanation. Of course, controlled demolition or some type of controlled demolition is the obvious answer because that's what it looks like, but yet they don't entertain that as a possibility.
Right. Yeah. They didn't seriously test that hypothesis, either in the case of the Twin Towers or Building 7. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be fair to say that they don't really have an explanation of the Twin Towers coming down either. In fact, in the case of Building 7, at least they say, well, okay, it was fire that brought it down. We can't give all the details. We'll try and come up with a computer simulation, and it'll be pathetic.
Yeah.
In the case of the Twin Towers, they say something similar. Oh, yeah, there was fire, and fire weakened this, and so on. But then if you look carefully, you'll find that they never try to explain the complete collapse. They simply say, well, no, we figured it would be enough to show how the collapse began. They call it collapse initiation. Well, sorry, no, that's not adequate. That's not what you were tasked to do. You were tasked to explain what happened. And you can't say, it would be like some guys get into a bar fight in a bar, and one of the guys gets hit in the face with a fist, and then his body disintegrates. And, you know, the detective investigating it says, well, what do you mean, how did he disintegrate? He got hit in the jaw. And my investigation only took it up to the part of physical disintegration, mm-hmm. You know, the first act. You know, disintegration initiation, that would be his word. You know, I didn't bother looking at how the fist actually resulted in his whole body falling apart. It's somewhat similar to what NIST did. And you'll actually find them, they say that quite explicitly, by the way, in a footnote in the NIST report on the Twin Towers. You know, we only took it up to collapse initiation. Well, that... I'm sorry, that doesn't work. You've got very robust buildings which were designed precisely so that they would not come down, even if a plane rammed into them, even if there was a massive fire. So don't talk to me about how it initiated. I want to know how the whole thing came down. Well, you won't learn that. And believe me, I read over 4,000 pages of not just the final report on the Twin Towers, but all those sections of the previous reports, the reports that preceded the final report, all those that bore on the actual collapse as opposed to irrelevant issues, I read it all, and there's nothing in there that explains the complete collapse of those towers. And of course, as I point out in the article, they didn't collapse anyway. They were violently and rapidly pulverized. You know, these buildings over 1,300 feet high turned into dust and powder and kind of sand-like substance in less than 20 seconds. And then with enormous force, this cloud of pulverized debris was pushed in all directions through the streets of Manhattan, engulfing people, in some cases having so much energy that they threw people, these clouds, threw them in the air. This is not a gravity-driven collapse, and I give some references in the article to studies that show that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, apparently the one physicist cited it's like 2.5 times the energy required.
Yes, yeah. This is a retired professor of civil engineering, Robert Coral, and he says in his computations it would take at least 2.5 times the energy provided that gravity would provide to result in what we actually saw. And I mean, I know this man, Robert Coral, and I interviewed him, I talked to him about this, and he said to me, Graham, look, I mean, these figures I've given here are really, really conservative, because I didn't even try to compute the amount of energy required to pulverize the walls in the building, the bodies in the building, the furniture in the building. I didn't look at the energy it would take to propel all this material through the streets of New York. So he said, you know, 2.5 times is an extremely modest conservative thing. The point is, in other words, just for people listening, it would take way more energy to turn those buildings into powder and propel them through the streets of New York than was available, according to the official story. The official story tells us that the buildings collapsed. In other words, gravity was the only energy available at that time to produce these pulverized buildings. And Coral and others who've studied this say gravity would not do it. Gravity, well, first of all, wouldn't even bring the buildings down. But if they did come down, there'd still be large chunks of material available, and things would fall straight down rather than being projected out, you know, hundreds of feet in all directions. And certainly you would not get those highly energetic, highly pulverized clouds of material rushing through the streets.
And you would have got much more resistance from below, because the three quarters of the building was fully intact and undamaged, so you wouldn't have gotten...
Absolutely. I mean, I've talked to Robert Coral about this many times because he's done a number of studies. He doesn't believe the buildings would have come down at all, never mind be pulverized the way they were. And this is the result that many others have achieved also who've studied this. In fact, this has been so well studied by now, the actual destruction of these three buildings, that I'm reluctant even to debate it with people anymore, because it's become a false debate. Mm-hmm. It's like Vincent Salandria, who was one of the great students, he's still alive, of the JFK assassination. After a certain number of years, he said, I'm not going to debate this anymore. He said, this has been so well shown. This was not Lee Harvey Oswald, okay? This was not any lone nut. This was a group of insiders. And we know that, and it's been shown. And I'm not going to debate it anymore, because when you debate it, it makes it look like, oh, gee, we're not really sure, so we're going to come out with another new piece of evidence. But we are sure. And this simply prolongs the period when society needs to accept this and come to grips with it and act on it. And I'm feeling similar about 9/11. I give, you know, a footnote now when I talk about the collapse of the buildings. I'll say, well, see this source. But I'm not really interested anymore in giving long arguments about this beam and that column, and, you know, because it's been done. And the conclusion is clear.
Yeah, and of course the imagery of the planes slamming into the buildings and the huge, you know, ball of fire was there to create the suggestion that great damage would be done to the buildings, and there to explain the impending collapse. But if you if you subtract that imagery from that event of the planes hitting into the building, no one would have looked at the collapse of the buildings, would have concluded that something hit the buildings. They would have said, "Oh, this obviously is some sort of controlled demolition of one variety or another, because it's symmetrical." You know, you don't get symmetrical collapse from asymmetrical damage,
right?
So it's one of those things where the planes, their function, their imagery here was to shock the huge ball of flame. It's this is where you get the Hollywood angle of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. This is what I called in the article the rules of dramatic action. You know, the rules of dramatic action, you want to create a spectacle for people. So you use special effects, and you have violence, and you have conflict, and you have drama, and you have lots of explosions. Hollywood loves explosions. You can hardly watch anything now without explosions.
Like a Michael Bay movie or something, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You could be watching a movie about the family and their toy poodle, and you'd have an explosion. I mean, they love them. You know, so anyway, my point is, you're right. So you have the plane and the explosion, and that captures everybody's imagination. Then they see the buildings come down, people screaming in agony and running away. It's all very dramatic, but it violates the laws of physics.
Yeah.
And I began to understand more and more as I thought about this that there's a conflict between the rules of dramatic action and the rules by which the physical world actually works, which we call the laws of physics. Mm-hmm. And that if you can get people sufficiently spellbound, if you can sort of hypnotize people with your dramatic B movie, then they will have suspended their belief in the laws of physics. They will believe anything you tell them. They will buy the movie. They will fail to distinguish it from reality.
Yeah, that's, you see it in a lot of movies. You know, a good example is the movie Jaws.
right.
Which is a fantastic movie. You build so much, you invest so much into the movie. Watching it at the very end, Steven Spielberg and Tyler Shark jump onto the boat and sink it.
Right.
And people buy it because it's Super Shark, right? It's a movie, you know, right. But you buy it. It works. It works.
Yeah.
You know, it
yeah.
works. So that's the effect of the movie where you suspend your critical faculties for the benefit of being entertained.
And exactly.
As gruesome as 9/11 was, is in we were entertained to the point that we were mesmerized and taken in by it and manipulated by that. And the huge explosion itself, from what I understand, is the bigger the explosion, the weaker it is in physics.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there was, as far as we know, that was caused by jet fuel.
Yeah.
And I say as far as we know because it's certainly not beyond the bounds of possibility that other things may have been added to those planes. Mm-hmm. But certainly you do have planes crashing and have balls of fire. So let's assume it's jet fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's very impressive, but it burns off very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, it can't melt or even substantially weaken the structural steel in that kind of a building. And that's why NIST had to go to this, NIST meaning National Institute of Standards and Technology, had to really fish around for ways to try and make this collapse seem reasonable. And in the end, they were unsuccessful. But I mean, they had to, so, oh, let's see, we'll say that the planes knocked all the fireproofing off the steel, even though we don't really have any evidence that happened substantially. We'll hypothesize that. And we'll say a number of exterior columns and core columns were severed and others were damaged. And we know to some extent that's true. We can certainly, with the external columns, we can see it. We'll ignore the fact that that's a minority of columns and that there was such redundancy built into the building that shouldn't have. There's no way that should have caused collapse. And in fact, you were saying a moment ago about how dramatic the plane and the ball of flame was. That's true. But after that happened, the rest wasn't very dramatic.
No.
I mean, certainly people leaping to their deaths was dramatic. But if you look at the video footage and the still camera footage of, let's say, the North Tower, between the time when it was hit and the time when it came down, it gets less and less dramatic. I mean, there's a hole, right? And mm-hmm. there's some columns that have been damaged and some have been cut. And you have obviously a fire of some sort, although you can't really see the flames as time goes on. You see black smoke coming out. You know it's not too hot up there because you have a woman standing there hoping to be rescued, holding on to the columns right in the gap where the plane went in.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of the South Tower, you have the firefighters who actually made it up to the site just before the building was brought down and saying, you know, there's a certain number of fires here, but we can knock them down with a couple of lines. So no problem. The guy says, it's okay. I'm coming up the stairs. I've got the hoses. So they're all set to put out the fires. And then, of course, miraculously, the building comes down right under their feet. So I guess my point there was the buildings were looking less and less dramatic. And it was more and more clear that the buildings were going to survive. They were designed to survive. There was no reason whatsoever for them to come down. They had taken the impact the way they were supposed to take the impact. And then suddenly, blam, the whole building is turned into powder and the steel is cut and the whole thing disappears in less than 20 seconds. It's amazing, really, that people can't see how fishy that is.
Yeah, again, I think it's the trauma of the day. Of course, early on, I think was it Paul Bremer who first identified Osama bin Laden as the perpetrator?
It may have been Bremer that did. He's certainly a very suspect character. I don't remember who was the first one to mention Osama, but he certainly got mentioned in all the major news channels and was assumed to be the culprit by the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, did he have an office at the tower? He just wasn't there that day?
you mean Osama?
He might have. Paul Bremer.
I don't remember if Bremer had an office there or not.
But I remember he was, I got that right. I might have that detail wrong. I know, nevertheless, it was almost like there was no investigation of obviously the later morning, Osama bin Laden is being mentioned. Of course, the myth of Osama bin Laden.
Right.
It had been nurtured for a couple of years.
Yes.
Al-Qaeda and what Al-Qaeda is and what it isn't. And,
yes.
You know, there's all types of questions about Al-Qaeda. People have done the research. It's, you know, that it grew out of Mujahideen. That was a Pakistani ISA, CIA operation. Yeah. Operation.
Yes.
You know, during the Afghan war. And so they had ties back to that. But, yeah, I mean, so, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt your flow there, because everything you were saying was quite correct. I actually, although I was trying to do peacemaking and peace building work, I was deeply involved in the Center for Peace Studies at my university, but I hadn't paid that much attention to Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda, to tell you the truth. And there's something weird about how I found out about them. I was in February 2001, a few months before those attacks, I was in Pakistan, and we were actually putting on peacebuilding sessions with an expatriate university. What do they call them? They just call themselves the Afghan University in Peshawar in Pakistan. In other words, these were refugees, people who had had to flee from Afghanistan, and they were right across the border in Pakistan. And there were a lot of faculty members and so on. And so they made a little temporary university and put it in Peshawar. And that's the university that invited us, a bunch of us, to come and do peacebuilding workshops for a week. So we did. Well, anyway, at one point, excuse me, I'm in the car and we go to Islamabad, where all the diplomatic offices are held in Pakistan, and I'm waiting in the anteroom while the guy with me is visiting a very powerful man who has a lot of control over these things. And I'm sitting there in the anteroom, and I'm thinking, okay, any magazines I can read? Oh, here's a Time magazine. And the whole thing is about terrorism. I thought, oh, I guess I'll read this. And that was really my first serious introduction. I hadn't paid any attention to bin Laden before that. I think it was Time. I mean, it might have been another. I'm pretty sure it was Time magazine. It was one of those standard U.S. magazines. And they had a long article on Al-Qaeda and bin Laden and their global reach and everything. And I was quite fascinated. I thought, how come I hadn't paid much attention to these guys? And what a strange place for me to be reading about that, right? Yeah. Right next to Afghanistan. And then, of course, while we were there, we also heard from a variety of Afghans that some U.S. armed forces had already been seen in Afghanistan. And that it was pretty well known, according to one gentleman, that the U.S. was going to invade in a few months Afghanistan. I heard all this in February 2001, right, on the scene. And I couldn't make sense of it. I thought, why would the U.S. be invading this poor little poverty-stricken country? Surely they're not going to make the same mistake the Russians made. And I, of course, again, I was naive. I didn't know that they were busily working at that moment to find a pretext for their invasion. And, well, there's so many things in retrospect that I didn't see and that I didn't understand. And the best you can do when that happens is say, I hope they don't fool me again.
Yeah, yeah. And the whole notion of nurturing or fomenting civil wars or promoting Islamic extremism as sort of a proxy force for Western influence in the area. Obviously, you had Brzezinski's scheme where he stirred up trouble in Afghanistan to draw the Russians in. This was a plan launched in the summer of 1979.
Yes.
And that delivered Afghanistan delivered Vietnam to the Russians in Afghanistan.
Right. And Brzezinski was proud of that.
Yeah. But of course, I think during the summer of 2001, you had these negotiations reportedly between the Taliban, and they apparently didn't take the deal, and they were reportedly threatened and given an offer they couldn't refuse. And, that's why, either you really accept our gold or take our lead, more or less. Now we look at Afghanistan, the poppy fields and, the importance of the heroin trade, the international drug trade to the Western financial system and these things, all these factor into, of course, with World Trade Center itself, that was sort of a, I know some of the Larry Silverstein had taken over the lease in the summer of 2001. And I think this, in the years prior, people had looked into demolishing it, but it was too expensive because of the asbestos removal. So how do you get around that? Well, you bring it down and collect the insurance. And that's what Larry Silverstein did, right? I mean,
he collected a lot.
Yeah. And of course, then you also have the, if you're familiar with the issue of these $240 billion bonds that were part of this intelligence operation, Operation Hammer in the 90s, was involved in the taking down and raping of Russia. And of course, the financial debacle, or the financial confusion that ensued from 9/11, gave the Federal Reserve pretext to sort of flood the market with liquidity and sort of cover these fraudulent bonds up. So there's a lot of financial chicanery going on around that day. The false, you've read about this spasm of fake trades that occurred just before the attack.
Yes.
Yeah, and also the missing gold. So I mean, there's a lot of intrigue here. The motivations behind it. But one thing you do get in your article is talk about the failure of imagination.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's a lie, right? Because there were a bunch of drills.
Oh, yeah. That's hilarious, really. Yeah. So the 9/11 Commission report pompously comes out with this as one of their explanations for 9/11, a failure of imagination. You know, that the national security institutions in the U.S. were not able to imagine that anyone would have done this in quite the way they did, and therefore, you know, they've... And the thing about that is it all sounded so reasonable. We can imagine the Pentagon, the CIA, these big, huge, overblown institutions, highly compartmentalized, so that it's easy for us sometimes to believe that, yeah, one compartment might not know what another compartment was doing, and it's a huge bureaucracy, and bureaucracies aren't noted for their imagination. And so I think that the failure of imagination hypothesis was welcomed and seemed reasonable by many people, including not just conservative people, but liberals and people on the left and so on. People who don't like the Pentagon bureaucracy and who are ready to believe just about anything bad about it. So, oh yeah, I can imagine those guys having a failure of imagination. I mean, they're clever, but they're not really smart. And, you know, so I can imagine a group outwitting them. But as I say in the article, what we may think, what our prejudices about the Pentagon may be, are irrelevant. What we need to look into is, did they in fact imagine such scenarios? Do we have evidence? And we do have evidence that they imagined all sorts of scenarios. When I say they imagined them, I don't just mean they thought about them while they were having a beer. They did training exercises for years on people hijacking planes and crashing them into not just the Twin Towers, but the UN and the Pentagon and on and on. And so, in fact, it turns out they had plenty of imagination. And they also had, obviously, people who scripted these exercises and people who enacted these exercises. Some of them would have been tabletop exercises, but some of them would have been, you know, involving real actors and planes and so on. And so the failure of imagination hypothesis is wrong. Therefore we have to say who in the world had the imagination, who had actually practiced this kind of stuff, who had the logistical experience, who had the resources, who could have directed, produced, scripted, who could have hired the crisis actors, and so on. And it turns out, of course, the U.S. national security state is far more competent at all of those than bin Laden's pathetic little group.
Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned the... in the article, this is officially after the attacks, that there was consultation with Hollywood screenwriters and directors. And
so right.
Brainstorming. Yet this seems perhaps that maybe this this type of brainstorming might have occurred prior to the attacks. Maybe.
I mean, somebody should write more about that. Actually,
yeah.
I didn't try to actually look into the the Hollywood Pentagon sort of connection in any detail in this article. I simply said that, yeah, we're told the Army's Institute for Creative Technologies got together with Hollywood screenwriters like D'Souza very quickly after 9/11, in October, actually, in the following month. And they had a secret meeting and all this. And we're told that the idea here was that, you know, the Pentagon and the relevant intelligence agencies sort of had recognized that they had a failure of imagination, and they were kind of ashamed. And so they wanted to call in these Hollywood types to brainstorm with them. Well, I think that was all baloney.
Mm-hmm.
It was a smokescreen. I do think there were real reasons for the meeting, but not those reasons. From what we can tell about the meeting, and a lot of it still hasn't been released, but from what we can tell, what the Pentagon and its intelligence agencies did was to actually lecture these guys at one point about the war on terror and how serious it was and how serious terrorism was. And at least one of the scriptwriters has said, oh, yeah, we were blown away, you know. And I thought, well, that's a good reason to have the meeting, because if you can get major Hollywood people on board with the war on terror, they're going to produce all kinds of useful films, especially since the CIA already regards movies as one of the major American assets in the world for propaganda. So I think if we're looking for a particular aim for that meeting, it is recruiting Hollywood for the war on terror. And as you say, there's a whole other separate set of questions that I didn't ask, and that is, what were the consultations like before 9/11? And was Hollywood involved in some way? And if so, what parts of Hollywood? And those are interesting questions.
Yeah, because as you cite in the article, that the connections between Hollywood, the U.S. government, particularly the War Department, Pentagon, OSS, you know, then CIA, go way back. And it's a part of psychological warfare, culture control, manipulation. And they're going to be very interested in creating memes and out there that promote the agenda of the Pentagon or the U.S. government. In fact, I mean, this became official policy under Harry Truman when he started the Psychological Strategy Board.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the assumption is that this is targeting foreign countries and foreign governments. Well, no.
Right.
You know, obviously it's targeting the population in general.
Yeah,
and this type of manipulation goes across the board, because you've also had the what's written about in Francis Stoner Saunders' book, the Congress of Cultural Freedom, where supposed art, you know, modern art was promoted for some reason or another to contrast, you know, to Soviet realism or something. Magazines were produced, and, you know, magazines we thought were independent were not. You know, activists we thought were, you know, their own person or not, they're actually assets of the CIA for some sort of cultural or agenda here at home. So it goes deep. Mm-hmm. And it goes deep. I mean, so it's hard to know where it stops and where it begins.
Yes.
And also, when you're talking about Hollywood, CIA, Pentagon, they're not separate entities. Seemingly the universities aren't, because of the mass funding and research in these things. How, you know, the CIA ultimately backs a corporatist agenda. And Hollywood is a part of this corporatist system. So it's kind of like a semantical argument, because these are the same interests that manipulate the intelligence agencies and the military. So, you know,
they are interlocking institutions.
Yeah.
CIA is Wall Street.
Yes.
Exactly. So yeah, I agree. Now, the question, though, is how do we take those general truths and get specific about it? Can we research this in more detail and find out who was involved in planning and scripting and practicing 9/11? I haven't tried to do that, but that needs to be done.
And you get sort of this. I mean, have you looked into? I think obviously there's no. It's interesting. It's curious that some of the so-called predictive programming that occurred in various movies and magazines in the years, I mean, sometimes 20, 30 years before 9/11. This the That gets into a deeper understanding of what exactly went down and why these groups would want to do this, hoodwink the public, perhaps mock them. But, how many times 9/11 pops up in a movie somewhere? And this would, again, might be an indication of that connection between Hollywood and the Pentagon or these interests,
Yeah, it could be. In other words, it is a researchable topic.
Yeah.
I haven't researched it, though. Mm. I mean, there are people who've produced fascinating lists mm-hmm. of both TV programs and films that foreshadow or I don't know what else to say. Foreshadow might be the best term,
mm-hmm.
the 9/11 event. And even when I try and put on my most skeptical hat, it's difficult to look at some of these without going, my God, what's happening there? I mean, this TV show, The Lone Gunman, is yes. one of the creepiest. That's got to be one of the creepiest. And this is just a few months before the actual 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have these guys, trying to ride a plane right into the Trade Center. And then we have the reason for it. Well, because the Pentagon needs to... have an event of this kind to keep war going. And I don't know. When I watched that, I thought, wow, I don't know what this means. I mean, everybody involved in it, of course, protests their innocence. So, no, they had nothing to do with anything. But it's very hard to watch that and not think that there's some deep connection. So I hope that there are researchers who will lay this bare for us.
And also what it also suggests is also media complicity at this point.
Yes.
Because obviously they'd have to produce this movie. Now, they may be brought on to do it and not know what they're doing because it's compartmentalized.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to imagine something that could be produced and not it's so close to what really occurred. I mean,
it really was. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how you could have been an actor or anybody involved in that without scratching your head and wanting to raise some serious questions afterwards. But maybe you just realize that it's too dangerous. I'm not going to go there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And there's also what people, a lot of people doing research about connections between the Central Intelligence Agency and Hollywood and the Pentagon, how often... people within the CIA will meet with screenwriters and give them ideas and drop these things. And that was apparently what, the Lone Gunman had consultants. So did, it grew out of the X-Files, which had a lot of connections to intelligence, these things.
Yes, you're right. A number of the TV programs, not only the ones that were shown, but other ones that were planned for the fall of 2001, did have CIA consultants mm-hmm. on board. It's just astonishing to me how anyone. Oh well.
Well, you even remember The Simpsons had a thing where.
Lisa, no, I don't remember that. I never watched it. Tell us about it.
Lisa Simpson, they're going to New York, and
yeah.
there's a price on a $9.11 a day or something.
Okay.
She holds it up, and there's the Twin Towers there.
Oh boy.
So these things are interesting. No smoking gun, of course.
But, right.
It strains credulity to say that this is all coincidence. And this, again, this type of, mocking of the public that might be done by, because obviously psychopaths plan this stuff and they may get some sort of pleasure out of this stuff. Of course, that also could be the psychological warfare angle of it, is seeding the ground with these tantalizing bits to get everyone talking about it.
It
is psychological warfare.
It is psychological warfare. And there is a certain model of the citizen that is built into all this. I often think of Carl von Clausewitz, who was one of the most important war strategists in European history. And he wrote his magnum opus on war, in the early 1800s. And his view of the composition of society was interesting. He didn't come up with it. It wasn't his original idea, but but it was the basis of his view of warfare, and that is that you can divide society into three parts. There's the executive, and he was a Republican, so he wouldn't have imagined the executive to be just a king. Let's call it a group of people, a cabinet, let's say, within a wider, more or less representative body. And then there was the leadership of the military itself. He talks about it as the generals, for example. So we could call that in the U.S. the Pentagon. And then there's the body of people, the population as a whole. And he refers to it kind of tongue-in-cheek once or twice as the Holy Trinity, you know, these three different segments. And got to remember, this is a guy who came out of a fairly traditional Prussian tradition. I mean, he professional armies, you know, and that sort of thing. And yet he experienced the massive citizen armies that France was able to put in the field after the French Revolution. In other words, France had a revolution, and despite all its terrible aspects and bloodshed, one of the things it did was unleash the power of the population as a whole. And Napoleon was therefore able to field these armies, which were sweeping away all the best professional armies in Europe, including those of Prussia. You know, huge, not just because they were big and had all kinds of people in them, but also because they were fueled with revolutionary fervor and passion, willing to die for La France. And so he saw there was a lesson to be learned there, that the people could not be ignored, as you know, some earlier models, feudal kind of models of warfare would have done. They would just say, well, the people are more or less irrelevant. But no, he saw they weren't irrelevant at all. So he said, what do these three segments of society provide? Well, the executive provides the decision making and will decide, for example, when a war is necessary. That's not going to be a popular decision. In other words, that's a decision made by a small group of people. And the generals, that is the head of the military, will decide how to wage the war effectively. They don't question that it must be waged. They wage it. And the people, well, the people provide the passion, just like they did in the great French armies. And I find that a useful model. I keep coming back to it because I think that's the model that's still operative, even though in the U.S., as in other Western countries, we keep hearing about democracy and freedom. I think that Clausewitz's model is still in operation, although at times the Pentagon, the military, has taken over the executive. Sometimes the executive and the military are hard to distinguish anymore, but certainly the role of the people is to provide the passion and, of course, the bodies. And so notice the people don't have intelligence. They don't make decisions. They also don't have any skill that's particularly important, like the military. They have that emotion, you know. So they're a great herd that can provide all this passion and these useful bodies, but they must be directed by those who are their natural masters. And I you know, the documents we see in the U.S. that we have, that we gain access to, seem to me to be working on that model. So, for example, if you look at the Operation Northwoods planning document, this was from the 1960s on how to invade Cuba by cooking up a bunch of false actions, including a terrorist attack in the United States, and falsely blaming it all on Cuba. There's a very important line in that at one point that I always keep kind of in the front of my head, and it's that, you know, if we can blow up a couple of ships and do all these things and blame Cuba, it will produce, and this is a direct quote, a helpful wave of national indignation. That's yeah. Okay, in other words, it will rouse the herd to passion, right? National indignation. And once you've roused the herd to passion, whether it be fear, whether it be hatred, all these things are blended in, then you can manipulate them much more quickly. Whatever critical faculties they have will certainly fly out the window, and that's actually what usually happens mm-hmm. in these kinds of things. Certainly happened after 9/11. And you can ride that wave of national indignation and get permission to invade whatever country you want and to take away people's civil rights and all these things. And that is the essence, in my view, of the war on terror.
Yeah, yeah. It's a terror trauma. People, you know, again, suspend their critical thought, their fear. They can't look at something in a rational, clear way. They're just frightened, and they want someone to save them. An important function here is also technology. I ran across a quote by Neil Postman. He has a book called "Amusing Ourselves to Death."
Right.
And he says, to be unaware that a technology comes equipped with a program for social change, to maintain that a technology is neutral, to make the assumption that a technology is always a friend to culture is, at this late hour, stupidity, plain and simple.
Yes.
And I'm talking about is mass communication. Obviously, 9/11 was it was delivered to the mass of humanity through mass communication, television, for the most part. That's how we experienced it.
Yes.
And I'm reminded of a book by Christopher Simpson called The Science of Coercion. He goes, in the whole study of mass communication wasn't there to study it neutrally, something that was occurring anyway. It was mass communication was developed for the purpose of mass manipulation. And that goes back to the Radio Research Project. These are the folks that produced War of the Worlds radio broadcast, which wasn't an accident. And so we can see these effects of these mass events. And what's striking about that is, of course, that event is fake.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
I mean, to what extent the events that we experience today are real or fake is a subject of great debate. I think these events can be hybrid events. They can be exaggerated. Yeah. They can be, the narratives can be spun out of something, or they can be wholly faked in many cases because we're relying on pixelated reality. And we're just assuming because there's something watching on TV and that it's news and serious people are telling us this, not so serious anymore. Now they're usually,
by serious, you mean pompous.
Pompous, yeah. But this was true with Walter Cronkite. I mean, the whole entire, the Western, particularly here in the United States, CBS, ABC, all grew out of the psychological warfare agencies of the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And so there never was a golden era of journalism, let's just say that, or even broadcast journalism. It was always being manipulated. I don't know if you're familiar with Dave McGowan's research. He did a thing, a book on Laurel Canyon. And there's an interesting outfit there called the Lookout
Mountains. What's the name of the book, Tim?
He did it called Laurel Canyon.
Laurel Canyon.
Yeah, but it's the...
I haven't read it.
It's about how much of the... the music scene that came out of Laurel Canyon in the 1960s in the United States had connections to military and intelligence as a part of a cultural programming operation. But within Laurel Canyon, there's a studio called Lookout Mountain that was run by the Air Force.
Right.
And John Wayne, Marilyn Monroe, Jimmy Stewart, all these directors would go there and they all had security clearances. And apparently it was involved in developing film, propaganda film, but also test film from the atomic explosions. These things, but it was a high tech studio that for some reason was connected to Hollywood through the U.S. Air Force. Top security. So my point is, what extent is not just talking about Hollywood movies, for a purpose of propaganda to manipulate the culture, to promote a certain agenda or values, but also to what extent are they working with Hollywood and the special effects branch to create a certain reality, act like a certain magus, where the oligarchs have so many resources and technology at their disposal that they have the capacity now, through broadcast medium, because they're all dependent on pixelated reality to understand the world, they can literally, they can create a false reality that we live under and manipulate us that way.
I agree. I think this is really important. And when a so-called terrorist event happens, to keep the old war on terror going, because, of course, it's a very creaky thing, and at some point it's just going to collapse. But to keep it going, every now and then we need another terrorist event. Now, when that happens, I usually roll my eyes. Mm-hmm. So-called terrorism, non-state terrorism does exist, so that's always a possibility. Mm-hmm. You can't rule it out, but it's probably fake. And then you have there's a big toolbox, and you just mentioned the various options. It could be that that it was largely real, but these terrorists were actually recruited by intelligence agencies, and we know that the FBI does that all the time. Mm-hmm. What's his name? Now I've forgotten his book about manufacturing terror.
Was it Trevor Aronson?
Yeah. Trevor Aronson has studied that.
Yeah, it's the Terror Factory. Yeah,
the Terror Factory. He has studied it within constraints. He hasn't allowed himself, at least in that book, to really look at the full spectrum of what's going on. But in any case, we know that the FBI in your country and the RCMP in my country do this. They take poor, sad cases, people who are drug addicts or, you know, unemployed, poor, mentally ill, whatever, and try and turn them into terrorists and create an incident and then throw them in jail and keep the war on terror going. So it could be that, right, when a terrorist event happens. So it could be that. Or it could be, you know, half real and half fake, or it could be totally fake. And I agree with you. On TV, what do we really know and what do we really see?
Mm-hmm.
We see somebody shows us a picture of a car running over people. Well, it could be that that's a car running over people, or it could be that parts of it are fake. We're in no position to know. This really forces civil society, it forces citizens like us to engage in a kind of informational self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
We need to think about, what do we do then to find out what's real and what's not real? I actually gave an academic paper at a conference on this a few years ago. I don't remember the name of it, but I was trying to argue, this was for the PJSA, Peace and Justice Society of whatever, I don't remember what it's called. It's all the peace studies university programs in North America, to try to get them to see that there's no firm line anymore between a simulation and reality,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that many of these events are scripted and they're acted, and we know that there are institutions that do this for profit. We also know that the military has in-house facilities for this, simulations. And it's very hard for citizens to tell whether a thing is a simulation or a real event. Well, it wasn't too much interest. there was actually some anger and a lot of resistance to what I was trying to say.
Why do you think that is? It seems like a rational concern, a rational argument, whether you disagree with it or not. I mean, obviously there's a...
Yeah, no, it is rational, but, yeah. You know, people don't like... A lot of people get very upset, as you know, I'm sure, when
yes.
You suggest, for example, that 9/11 and anthrax attacks and the Boston Marathon and on have a lot of fakery involved.
Yeah.
Some of these people have staked their reputation on all these things being authentic. And some of them have staked even more than their reputation. They've staked their whole worldview. One person who actually taught peace studies for years, an old friend of mine, got really furious at me in public and said, look, if you're right about 9/11, my whole worldview will collapse. Hmm. And I thought, well, that was a moment of insight on this person's part. You don't normally hear them actually say that. But I think that that's true for a lot of people. It's like being told your dad has been abusing your sister for 20 years or whatever. And you don't want to think about it. You don't want to believe it. You get furious. You get angry. You take it out on the sister, you know, and so on. And so there are all kinds of reasons why people might get angry. But certainly I get that reaction a lot. I mean, I eventually, even though I helped create a peace studies program at my university and was founding director of the Center for Peace Studies and was a member of this international organization for years, I eventually just dropped my membership. I thought, I'm tired of fighting with the leadership in this organization about whether or not a critical view of 9/11 is something we ought to be developing. I've got better battles to fight than this. I just dropped it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very sad because, you know, people who are studying war and peace and people who are generally critical of mainstream institutions, you know, they should be looking at this. And I don't really know at this point how to get them to do that.
Yeah, it's what's funny thing is because you can cite, I mean, documented, generally accepted examples of media fakery or manipulation. Obviously, during the first Gulf War in 1991, CNN was caught, you know, staging fake Scud missile attacks.
Right.
You know, that's famous. There's the reporter, who was a CNN reporter. CNN was being paid by the government of Bahrain to produce stories favorable when they're actually being paid. So these are countless examples of this sort of fakery.
Well, I agree with you, Tim, but what you're suggesting is that I should use rational argument and evidence to convince these people. But the whole point is that they have been resisting rational argument and evidence for years. And I don't know how you make any progress, really, with people who are resistant. And the irony, of course, is that we get called conspiracy theorists. And you'll read all the time about how conspiracy theorists like us are completely resistant to evidence and argument, so that no matter what you say to us, we'll never pay any attention because we got our ideas already made up. Well, you know, that's not the way it worked with me. It took me a lot of investigation and reading to conclude 9/11 was an inside job. And the same with JFK assassination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went out and read the Warren Commission report, 888 pages, and I read parts of the 26 volumes of hearings, not the whole, but, you know, substantial parts, and so on and so forth. So I get annoyed when people say I'm resistant to evidence. But nonetheless, there are people that are resistant to evidence and reason, and I'm not sure what you do with them. I'm not sure how you break through that.
Well, I think it goes back to that herd. Our masters, or presumed masters, and their agents, the social scientists, the psychology, things like psychology, psychiatry, these things are generally... these are weapons that have been used, or at least they've been weaponized, and that's what MK Ultra was all about. And if you look at MK Ultra, it was there to. We kind of live in an MK Ultra world with the media and the entertainment complex and these things. Disney. If you look at the strange connection between Walt Disney Corporation and the intelligence agencies, SRI consulted in both in the construction of Disneyland, at the same time as consulting MK Ultra. And also the CIA helped build Disney World in Florida. So you have this strange help that Disney is getting from the CIA. Well, why is that? Well, because Disney itself is not only manipulating the culture through its media, what it produces, its entertainment. The two theme parks are like examples of the sort of this technocracy that maybe they want to impose on us. You heard about what they have set up there with Disney World with the... full monitoring. They have. They're trying to implement chipping guests that come there, and it's all done in the name of security. These things. So again, this complex that exists between entertainment, between movies, between media, between the corporate world and the CIA. It really is. Through interlocking directorates, these things are being coordinated. And it's not a crazy.
The question is, what do we do about it, though? That's the question.
Well, the first step is always consciousness.
Yeah.
Because much of the psychological warfare simply is neutralized by consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your example is being fearful of terrorism. You know, you don't have to be fearful of terrorism per se, at least not the type of terrorism they're saying. If, if indeed it's false flag terrorism. I had a while back, I had the pleasure interviewing Danielle Gansler. He wrote the book about Gladio.
Sure.
And yeah. He made the, you know, he talked about the, you know, he's an academic who's in many ways very vulnerable. I mean, yeah. Academics are very vulnerable. I mean, you know this. As an academic, is you don't have freedom of academic freedom, and there's also peer pressure, like anything else. No matter how old you, how wise you are, you always want to be accepted among your peers, and you're going to fear ostracism and these things. But he talked. He's just, you know, how his understanding of Gladiator fundamentally changed his understanding of how the world works, and how the whole meaning of the Cold War in Europe, and you know, Red Terror was actually, you know, a product of NATO. These NATO secret armies and Western intelligence agencies. It wasn't, and these groups like Bader Meinhof and the Red Guard. These weren't independent actors. These were actually, you know, being either manipulated or these were, you know, really these secret armies. These you know, fascist secret armies were manipulated to change the politics at the time. But he made the point. He just said that what people don't realize is when they see an event like 9/11, or maybe the Charlie Hebdo attacks, or the Boston bombing, or even the we had this spate of shootings here in the United States a couple of years ago, which were very fishy. And of course, that they had the similar thing occur in Belgium, that just shooting events that would terrify the public. Well, if you understand, if you have some understanding of Gladio or Northwoods, your analytical approach to these things are fundamentally different than the average citizen.
I agree. You know? Danielle's work on Gladio had a big impact on me. That's why I asked him if we could reprint one of his articles for the Journal of 9/11 Studies, even though it was mainly about Gladio and 9/11 was, you know, just a subsidiary bit. I thought the readers of the journal really, really need to know this man's work. And Danielle, though he's a fairly young guy, gave a talk on World Trade 7 that has basically gone viral in Europe. If you look at it on Facebook, it's got something like 10 million hits. Mm-hmm. It's the talk is in German, but I'm trying to have it English subtitles put on it. So he's a good example of somebody. Yeah, sure. If he's an academic, he's vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You know, the Journal of 9/11 Studies was started by two guys who were basically fired because of what they said about 9/11. One was Steve Jones, professor of physics at Brigham Young, who was forced into early retirement. The other was Kevin Ryan, who was a chemist in industry and who basically blew the whistle on, you know, what was being said about the steel and how the steel would have given way with the heat and so on. And he wrote a letter. I think it was an open letter to the head of his organization and was promptly fired. And that's one of the reasons I had such respect, by the way, for the Journal of 9/11 Studies. It's the only journal I know that was founded by two brave people who actually sacrificed quite a bit for what they believed in. That's why when years later I was asked if I would be a co-editor with Kevin, I said, oh, absolutely. I mean, it's run, we never had any money, we didn't have any assistance. It was very hard to keep it going, but still, and you know, of course, mainstream academics just sneer at it. But it was a genuinely peer-reviewed, you know, journal. And I know that because for 4 years, I was one of the guys who was sending out articles for peer review. And I hope that when somebody writes a history of the 9/11 truth movement, someday they will give that the proper respect.
Well, the irony, of course, here is that the many people who are critical of skeptics of the official narrative and who speak about the evidence of it, quote, being an inside job, for lack of a better word, and getting into the details of it, they'll be accused of sloppiness and not having evidence, as if your job is to produce the positive evidence. But if you go by the official narrative, what evidence is there? I mean, Osama bin Laden was never even indicted.
Right.
He wasn't even on the FBI's most wanted list for the attacks. And the FBI said we don't have evidence for it. That's why he's not on.
No, I completely agree. The burden of proof is on them to give evidence. It's not on us. And
Where are the videotapes of these guys getting on the planes?
Yeah, exactly. There aren't any.
There aren't any. Yeah.
No.
You know, so now what do we have? At the end of the day, we have a narrative, and probably of all the conspiracy theories, of all the swirling about 9/11, the official narrative is perhaps the most absurd.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course it is a conspiracy theory.
Yes.
That's another one of these terms that is used in the most interesting way. I find it hard to get involved in a debate about conspiracy theory because it all seems so childish to me. But the fact is that whether I like it or not, this is a very important propaganda term. It's been highly effective in marginalizing people, even though it makes no sense at all, especially as applied to 9/11, because it's obvious that 9/11 was the result of a conspiracy. Give me a break. Everyone agrees on that. So what do you mean I'm a conspiracy theorist? It doesn't matter. It's still used. And there are attempts being made now by several Western countries to criminalize conspiracy theories, to actually make it criminal. And they're moving incrementally in this direction. You can see it in the UK, for example, when he was Prime Minister, David Cameron gave a couple of very creepy talks in which he talked about extremism and how dangerous it is. And I forget what other term he uses. They use radicalization. They use extremism. He then went on to say that it wasn't just violent extremism that was dangerous, that even nonviolent extremism. He said it explicitly. UN, for God's sake. And so we have to be careful about even nonviolent extremism. And then he manages to link nonviolent extremism with conspiracies and conspiratorial thinking. And that in turn is linked in, of course, there's no evidence for anything given anywhere in the talk. That's linked to anti-Semitism. And so somehow people, for example, who don't accept the official story of 9/11, naturally all think that the Jews did it.
Yeah.
So we're all anti-Semitic, we're all conspirators, we're all extremists, and even if we're nonviolent, we're dangerous. And quite clearly working toward some way of making this criminal. And we do have people, I won't go on about that, but that's happening right now, and not just in the UK. This attempt in the EU generally is happening. It's happening in my own country, in Canada. You know, Anthony Hall was suspended from his position as a university professor. And so this is something that's happening right now that we have to take on and fight.
And, of course, the operative word should be not there. Should be you're a nonviolent.
Yeah.
Meaning that there's no reason for action to be taken against you because you're just voicing an opinion that another group may consider different than theirs, too different than theirs. And, you know, it's, you know, not a crime to speak your opinion in these things. But the whole term...
they're trying to make it a crime. That's the point. And in the UK, they're also pushing this idea of British values that, you know, you can be punished if you're violating British values. Well, that one's having a little trouble because they're having trouble defining British values. But we can expect to see this. This is, you know, like un-American activities, the same theme, that somehow it's a way of saying if you want to belong to this nation, you have to think like us. Otherwise, you know, we'll throw you in jail.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's very serious. It has to be taken very seriously.
And what people should always remember regarding conspiracy theory itself, that it itself was a product of a conspiracy because
right.
CIA in 1967 coined that phrase to marginalize critics of the Warren Report and had it disseminated or first abroad, then it came back to the domestic. That's how they do it. You know, they do their office, but then the media picked it up. And since then, you're a conspiracy theorist. That itself, you know, as if conspiracies have never existed throughout history and you can't theorize about them. I mean,
right.
And of course,
yeah, no, it's absolutely true. CIA was crucial to this propaganda move called conspiracy theory, which unfortunately we do have to take seriously, even though it seems so childish.
Mm-hmm. And you want to ask yourself if indeed the Warren Report was accurate and Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin, the lone nut who killed John F. Kennedy, why is the CIA involving itself in in that sort of a manipulation of the public by disseminating that stuff. You know, I thought this is supposed to be a broad fighting communist, not manipulating public opinion.
Right.
So, but that
that whole JFK thing is a whole other kettle of fish.
Yes.
And what was really the aim of that, and whether they had to go to a fallback position in the end. And it's very interesting, but it's certainly worth studying if you want to understand 9/11.
Yeah, because like JFK or Northwoods, which actually was revealed because of the JFK assassination.
Right.
It was Oliver Stone's movie, then
right.
the Records Review Board. Is whether it's the Gulf of Tonkin, Northwards, even Pearl Harbor, behind Pearl Harbor, because that's another incident where the failure to connect the dots was the excuse.
Yes.
And we all, now it's pretty much known that that was sort of a setup to get us into the war. But
right.
even with 9/11, you have Kevin Fenton, I think it's Kevin Fenton, who has a book, Disconnecting the Dots, where he meticulously goes through and shows how there was a superlative effort made not to make the FBI communicate with the CIA. It was high.
Right.
It was. You know, you had the whole thing with the 20th hijacker and the laptop and Spike Bauman not giving the warrant. You know, the FISA warrant approval, stopping the investigation. And again, all these people who screwed up got promoted.
Right.
So that's a good evidence there. But that, you know, again, getting the details of that, you realize how actually it was systematically prevented from the normal process happening. So it wasn't just like. It was designed not to work. It was actually, someone had to make a superlative effort. People like, I think it was Tom Wilshire, Richard Blee, and Spike Bauman. And it gets in the whole weeds, but if you do the research, you realize that the whole thing was prevented from the investigation from occurring, because at some point, street agents, mid-level agents are doing their job, and they're prevented from doing their job.
Right.
To let it go through, yeah.
So, yeah, no, yeah. It's certainly true that in all these agencies, there are good people who are trying to do their job. Well, when we're talking about JFK and 9/11, another thing I want to say is that the national security state, if you want to call it that, or the national security agencies learned from the JFK thing. I mean, they do learn.
Mm-hmm.
They try to get lessons and improve the next time. The question is, are we learning?
Yeah.
So, for example, with JFK, they they put together the Warren Commission, and with Chief Justice Warren at the head and all these guys, and they produced the Warren Commission report, which was big and long and had lots of footnotes and was built to intimidate people. But then they produced 26 volumes of hearings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they did their best, you might say, to make sure nobody read them. They didn't make them widely available. And, 26 volumes is pretty intimidating to begin with. They created no index, you know. So somebody said it's like getting the Encyclopedia Britannica with no index and no alphabetization, you know. So you could say they did their best to make sure no one would read it, but it was still very naive on their part, because there were people that read it. You know, Mark Lane read it, and mm-hmm. Vincent Salandria read it, and Sylvia Marr read it, and they all wrote really good things based upon it. It was very easy for them to show that the Warren Commission report, the final report, did not accurately portray what had been revealed in the hearings. It's very easy to show that. So my point here is that the national security people learned from that mistake. There are no 26 volumes with 9/11.
That's right. And I think, didn't they also produce a graphic novel or comic book for the average person?
They probably did. I don't know. But they produced the 9/11 Commission report, and even that was grudging. They didn't even want to have a 9/11 Commission. But then, of course, the so-called Jersey Girls forced them to. So we got a commission of sorts, and it produced this crummy report. But the point is, there's no 26 volumes of hearings
mm-hmm.
that people can go to. If you actually try and follow up the footnotes in the 9/11 Commission report, you know, you'll see a remarkable statement made in the report. So you look in the footnote, it'll say KSM May 11th, 1999 or something, and you go, Well, KSM stands for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. So this presumably means after we tortured him,
yeah.
He came out with a statement on May 11th, blah, blah, blah. Well, okay, that's interesting. So where can I follow that up? Who can I find out who waterboarded him that day? Because he was waterboarded, as far as we can tell, at least repeatedly. But we don't even know what he said as a result of it. They didn't give us the reports. And even the 9/11 Commission report wasn't allowed to interview KSM. They weren't even allowed, the 9/11 Commission was not even allowed to interview the people who interrogated him. So in other words, what kind of a footnote is that? KSM May 11th. Most of us who are academics or who spend any time at all in university, we think of as a footnote as a place that will tell you where you can go to find out more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a footnote is something, you know, that makes what you've said secure by, you know, giving it a basis. And the 9/11 Commission reports footnotes aren't that at all. They usually are dead ends. There's nowhere you can go to find out that KSM actually said that or what happened to him or who interviewed him or anything else. So what the footnote really says is not, here's where you can go. It says, take this and shove it. So that's why I say to people, that whatever that 9/11 Commission report is, it's not an academic production. It's also not good journalism either. It's the worst kind of cover-up.
Yeah, yeah. And they said it reads like a novel, which should make you suspect right there.
Right. September 11th dawned cool and clear.
Yeah, you know,
that's the way it's written.
Yeah, yeah. It had to be a clear day, of course. Just like Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor was a clear morning.
That's right. They have to be clear to contrast with the evil that is soon about to erupt into the skies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they have, you know, the magazines like Time Magazine, Ethnic Texas, they have an image of Bin Laden on the cover, the face of evil. I was like, come on.
Right.
Is this real, exactly. serious journalism? Are they,
yeah. You know,
with media taking a posture like that, I mean, no one's going to
get the bottom. I know. We had the same thing in Canada. We had a major, so-called major journalist in the Globe and Mail, which is supposed to be Canada's equivalent of the New York Times, and probably is.
Exactly.
You know, saying that, you know, we shouldn't even be trying to understand these terrorists because they're not real human beings. They have, I forget what she said they had in their veins, but it wasn't blood. Maybe it was ice water or something. And I thought, oh, give me a break. And then, of course, when the invasion of Iraq came, she publicly called right in the newspaper for the bombing of mosques, which, of course, is a war crime. And, you know, and the paper allowed what's-his-name, former Harvard law professor Dershowitz, to write an op-ed on how torture should be legalized, you know. I thought, what is the world coming to?
Yeah.
I never thought I would live to see a major newspaper in my country giving a guy space to argue for the legalization of torture. I really didn't think it would come to that.
Well, this is the violation of due process and habeas corpus, because they'd say, well, a terrorist doesn't deserve the benefit of laws and due process.
Right.
Well, how do you know someone who's accused of being a terrorist is a terrorist without that due process?
I mean, exactly. Well, we're all, but you and I are supposed to be too stupid to see that.
Yeah.
That's their assumption. We're too stupid to ask that question. We're just supposed to accept it, that when they say there's bad guys in Guantanamo, well, there must be bad guys.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And everyone knows what, you know, well, not everyone knows, but if you do the research about what occurred in the wake of 9/11 in Afghanistan, is that there are bounties paid. And
yeah,
locals had, whether it's vendettas or just want to get money, they just turned people over and they were just swooped up. And
yeah.
And so you had a lot of innocent people being dragged out, scooped up, and then, you know, flown, you know, thousands of miles away from their homeland and dumped in a cell somewhere without any accountability or sunshine, which means Lord knows what they went through. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
You know,
and I still remember shortly after the Western forces decided to align themselves with the Northern Alliance, mm-hmm. as it was then called, the enemies of the Taliban, to sweep up the Taliban. Now, I've never been a fan of the Taliban, okay, and I have been to Afghanistan, talked to people about the Taliban. So, okay, like nobody in the West is a fan of the Taliban. Mm-hmm. If you're a conservative, let's say U.S. patriot, you obviously hate them because you think they were behind 9/11. And if you're a liberal, you hate them because they're not liberal. And if you're a leftist, you hate them. So everybody hates them.
Yeah.
Feminists hate them, everybody. And that's fine. But the brutality that was facilitated against these guys, most of them were semi-literate guys from rural villages, mm-hmm. who were trained in these hardcore madrasas funded by Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And to just tell people, oh yeah, you can bomb the hell out of them, it doesn't matter, they're not real people.
Yeah.
And I remember a series of photographs in, again, I think it was the Globe and Mail in Canada, shortly after Western governments had decided to join with the Northern Alliance, and the sequence of photos had originally shown in detail the killing of a Taliban guy by the Northern Alliance, but they had, if you looked closely, you could see they left out a couple of the photos. So we saw them dragging him, and then we saw him dead. And what we didn't see, but which you could infer if you looked at it closely, was that they not only killed him, they pulled down his pants and castrated him. Because in the last photo, there was blood all over his thighs. And I thought, this is in our newspaper again, as showing, you know, that finally the Taliban are getting their just desserts. It's just so stinking and low. You know, really low.
Yeah. And it was right after 9/11, the Taliban was told to turn over Osama bin Laden. And they said, well, provide us evidence that he's guilty, and we will. Yeah. And, of course, that evidence was never forthcoming.
No. Bush said, we're not going to give you evidence. Just hand him over. And I thought, you know.
Yeah, so, but again, people are so, again, this goes back to when our conversation started, is the whole point is that people are so either filled with a sense of vengeance and righteous indignation or fear that they're not stopping to think about these things.
Right.
You know, that's the,
That's what you do. Yeah. You create that in the population, and too often we, civil society, live up or rather live down to the expectations of these people. Mm-hmm. And too often we do react uncritically. And so our job is to try and, as you said, somehow get our own consciousness working and then try and raise it in others as well. It's difficult.
Just be a little skeptical. Be a little skeptical. Don't be so gullible, you know, about these things.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think there was a book back in the 50s or 60s, is The Paranoid Style of American Politics.
Okay, I haven't read it.
And I think there should be another book written about the gullible style of American politics.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I wish it was just American, but...
Yeah. Oh, I know, yeah. It cuts across the board there. So, well, Graham, I want to thank you for coming back on the show.
It's been great talking, Tim. Thanks. You very much.
Any projects, or are you just taking it easy now, or...?
Well, I usually take it easy for a couple of weeks after I've finished an article.
Okay.
And then I brainstorm. So I'm getting some ideas for the next one, but I won't go into that today.
Okay. Well,
maybe we can talk once it's out.
Yeah, I'll take a look at it. So that is your article, 9/11, the Pentagon B movie. I saw it at Global Research's website. It's still there.
Yeah.
You can go there, take a look at the article. It's a very good article, very, very thought-provoking, very insightful. It raises a lot of questions about the whole event and what we talked about tonight, about what is reality and what actually did occur. And we just can't rely on the legacy media, the mainstream media, the idiot box, the television, to tell us what's going on in the world. It's difficult. It creates sort of an epistemological problem, I guess you could say.
Yes, absolutely.
You know? So if it's not right before your very eyes, you have to be very skeptical about it, you know? So,
yeah.
Well, thank you. I'll let you go. Wish you a good night. And, I'll be posting this in a day or so. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Thank you, Tim. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. And good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.